Hare Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvatyam Gauravani Pacharine Nirvishesha Shunyavari Pasyachara Satarine Ukam Kuroti Vachalam Pankam Nange Jagirinya Kripata Mahamane Sri Vindhya. So, just for your information, today, this is the plan for the rest of the week. Today we'll discuss text 4. Tomorrow, text 5 and 6. Wednesday, text 7 and 8. And Thursday, 9, 10, and 11. Okay? Dadati pratigri nati guhyam akyati prichati bhungte bhojayate chaiva sadvidam priti lakshanam. Offering gifts in charity, accepting charitable gifts, revealing one's mind in confidence, inquiring confidentially, accepting prasad and offering prasad are the six symptoms of love shared by one devotee and another. So this is Chaya Begadami, Chaya Dosha Shori, Chaya Gunade Hadase, Chaya Satsanga. Please, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is praying, please let me have the six kinds of holy association or the six kinds of loving exchanges among the devotees. So first I would like to discuss a little bit, and before we go through Prabhupada's purport, I want to discuss a little bit about this word priti, or Prabhupada translates it love. So he says, these are the six symptoms of love. Offering charity, accepting charity, revealing one's mind, inquiring confidentially, giving and taking prasadam. So these are symptoms of love between the devotees or among the devotees. Right? So you notice there's no mention of sex here. In other words, sex may be, in other words, if one has love, say if a husband has love for his wife, he may express it in sex. But in order for love to be there, sex doesn't have to have anything to do with it. But it's based on these six things. So we have a common misconception in the material world that love and sex are always tied together. But we see throughout the scriptures that love is not always... It's very often not mixed with sex. I remember a specific example was when Lord Ram was fighting on the battlefield, you know, against Ravana. And at that point, Lakshman was injured and he fell on the battlefield. He was injured by, was it Indrajit? And they sent Hanuman to get this reviving herb. And he brought it back, and they revived Lakshman. And then there was an exchange between Ram and Lakshman. Whereas Ram said, you know, we're fighting this whole battle because someone stole Sita, my beloved wife. He said, but you know, I could actually withstand the loss of Sita if necessary. It would be a big shock to me, but I could bear it. But then he told Lakshman, but to lose a brother like you, I could not bear it. So at least this statement indicates that the love Ram had for Lakshman, which is a brotherly love, was stronger or was actually more important to Ram. So it doesn't mean that brotherly love is always stronger than love between husband and wife. It doesn't mean that. But it does mean that love can be developed among brothers, among God brothers, among brahmacharis, among men, that is very, very strong, even stronger than sometimes the love that can be developed between a man and a woman. And we see in practical experience, though, that at least in my personal experience and in other relationships that I have observed, whereas undoubtedly sex between husband and wife has the ability to say increase intimacy, but it also has a destabilizing factor. At least it has a potential to disrupt the relationship. And my personal experience is those relationships, those loving relationships, where sex is not a factor, they seem to live longer. They seem to last longer. The relationships where sex is not involved seems to, at least in my, I mean, it doesn't always have to be, this is not a universal statement. It's not a conclusive statement, but it's just a statement of observation and personal experience that while sex has the power to make intimacy, it also can cause a destabilizing factor. Of course, there cannot be other destabilizing factors where sex is not involved. But the point is that here in this verse, sex is not mentioned as one of the six exchanges, that's something that exists between husband and wife. But strong love can develop among the devotees, and a very stable and satisfying love can develop and should develop according to following these six principles. Prabhupada writes in one place, sex life, though it has the power to bind, this hridaya granti, this knot in the heart that Prahlad Maharaj talks about. He says sex has the power to bind two people together, but it also bewilders one for some time, and in due course does nothing more than disrupt relationships. Even ghastly murder scenes often result between persons who are so-called in love. Relationships that are not based on sex are stronger and more rewarding than those based on sex. Now, there's in this, as we examine these six symptoms, we're going to see that there's giving and taking, giving and taking, giving charity, accepting charity, offering prasad, accepting prasad, revealing one's mind, and then inquiring. So there's giving and taking. And the fact is that giving is more important than taking. There's a statement, I think it comes from the Christian scriptures, that it is better to give than to receive. Now we know from the law of karma that if you give, it's inevitable that you're going to receive. Right? Because by giving to someone, you create karma that someone is going to give to you. But of course, giving should not be done in that attitude that, you know, I'll give something and I'll get it back in double. No, but the devotees should practice love by, in other words, if you want to develop love among your peers and elders and juniors, then you concentrate on giving love. Now there's, again, okay, so this is the first point I want to make, is that in order to develop love, we should have the attitude that I'm going to give. And whether or whenever I get in return, well, that's up to Krishna. But I'm oriented towards giving. Each one of us should be oriented towards giving if we want to develop love. Now, the another misconception is that love is a feeling. That we sometimes hear, well, they met, you know, this man and this woman, they met and they fell in love. Neither of them intended to, but it just happened. They just fell in love. So this is a misconception, because love is not something that you fall into. Love is not a feeling. But love is an action. Love is actually a verb. To love. So it indicates action. And a feeling or a sentiment, that is a byproduct of the action. If the activities are these six, and after a series of positive activities, then perhaps sentiment or feeling of love develops. But it's not that people fall in love without making any attempt to serve each other. What they fall into is lust. So we have to very clearly distinguish between lust and love. And lust is, of course, oriented towards oneself, getting something to satisfy the desires of oneself. It's based, lust is based on taking, right? That is the element of lust, is that I want to take something from another person to satisfy my desires. And love is, like we discussed just a minute ago, is based on giving. I want to give something to this person that will benefit him or her. So this is the basic difference between lust and love. And people fall in lust, and they're thinking, as Prabhupada says, it is more like a business arrangement, that I will satisfy your sense, your demands of your senses if you agree to satisfy the demands of my senses. And as long as that exchange is going on, the relationship remains. But as soon as one person, one partner, fails to satisfy the other, then there's a disruption in the relationship, or some tension and gradual disruption. So then, in order to develop love, first of all, we have to distinguish it from lust and understand fully what it means, what it is. As we discussed, it's an activity. And that activity involves extending oneself, giving oneself to help others or another person develop into all that they can be, to develop their potentiality to the fullest that they are able to. In other words, it means looking at another person, understanding what that person is apart from yourself, and then trying to help that person develop into his full capacity as a person, as a devotee. In other words, sometimes a father looks at his son. Obviously, there's a natural love between father and son, or mother and son. And sometimes we hear parents saying, well, I want my son to become this. I want my son to become a devotee. I want my child to become, you know, educated. Often the parents want to give their children the things that they did not get. And so they try to satisfy some of their own desires through the life of their child. And so they give to the child things that they would have liked to have without considering whether the child likes it or not. And so sometimes it appears that they love and concern, they're concerned about the child, but in actuality they're trying to fulfill their desires through the life of the kid. And sometimes the kid rebels because the parents are not taking into consideration his likes and dislikes. They're not taking into consideration who he is apart from them. So then love means that much, that we try to give those things required, or whatever is required, to another person to help them develop to their fullest capacity, and we're not expecting anything in return. So this kind of attitude involves four factors. First, care and responsibility. That you must be concerned, you must care about the other person. You must take responsibility to satisfy that person. And you must have respect. You must respect the other person as an individual, apart from yourself. And you must, in order to do these things, in order to care and feel responsible for and respect the individual, you have to have knowledge of that person. You have to have knowledge. So the four elements of love are then care, responsibility, respect, and knowledge. Sorry, knowledge of the person. Just like if I want to develop love with you, I have to know something about you. I want to know why you look so young but you have so many gray hairs. I want to know where you came from. I want to know about your background, your parents. I want to know why you're wearing white and you don't have a wife. I want to know... So like that, we have to have knowledge of the person. of their characteristics and their likes and dislikes, their personality, what will actually please them. We have to know what are their desires. Through this process of revealing our minds in confidence and inquiring confidentially, we learn these things. And then from this knowledge, we can learn to have full respect for each other, and we will know how to care and be responsible for each other. So these are some of the elements that are involved in developing these relationships. And Prabhupada writes very early on in the purport, he says, "The International Society for Krishna Consciousness has been established to facilitate these six kinds of loving exchanges between devotees." He says, so this is one of the purposes of the Krishna Consciousness Movement, is to facilitate these things. So now it means when we're relating among ourselves, we should be trying to give to each other, not take from the other. But we should be oriented towards giving. At least a devotee who wants to develop love of God is going to have to practice on the devotees, on the spiritual master. And it's not that sometimes we think, well, we can love Krishna. It's Krishna, maybe, well, Krishna, Guru, and then myself, and everybody else is out of the picture. Or else at least everyone else is behind me in the queue. It's me, Guru, and Krishna, and everybody else, get out of the way. But this verse does not indicate that this is how it is. In other words, we're meant to see, if we have love of Krishna, that means we have knowledge of Krishna. And knowledge of Krishna means we know that we are all part and parcel of Krishna, that you are part and parcel of Krishna. And therefore, if I treat Krishna with respect and I'm disrespectful to his parts and parcels, there's no question of love. Just like this is actually a symptom of a Kanista Adhikari. That and Lord Kapila explains to his mother, Devahuti, that devotional service performed under the lower modes of nature are when one is very respectful towards the deity, but he treats the devotees of the deity disrespectfully. He says, he compares that action. He compares the worship he does of the deity is compared to pouring a ladle of ghee onto the ashes. There's no fire there. Fire is the mouth of Vishnu. So the mouth of Vishnu is closed, and I'm pouring ghee on the ashes and saying swaha means the offering is not being accepted. So one who worships the deity very nicely but doesn't demonstrate these six symptoms of love with the devotees, then it is highly unlikely that Krishna is accepting his offering. So this is the attitude we have to develop. We have to understand clearly what is love, and that it involves giving rather than taking, that it involves giving without expecting something in return, even indirectly. And it is an activity. That's why it involves, it's like care and responsibility indicate action. So it is an activity. It is not a feeling. Feelings may develop after the activity. So now let's examine, like we're saying, that two people do not fall in love, but they develop love among themselves or between themselves. So now let's think. What are the stages that precede love? In other words, in your experience of having love for someone, what are the exchanges? What are the experiences you have before you actually feel love for a person? You care about them? Okay, you hear about them. That's your developed knowledge about them. Madhavendra Puri? Affection. Affection is, okay, but affection and love are pretty much the same, aren't they, or no? I guess affection is lesser. Okay. Okay? So before affection.
These qualities, like samadhi, siya,
good behavior, achara. Okay? Okay, you develop some respect. Prabhu? Service? You see, I'm sorry, I don't know. I mean, service in... Oh, you have to serve each other, what you're saying. Is that what you're saying? Okay, good. All right, this is actually, I think, right at the... If you're going to develop... If you're going to try to develop love for someone, then you exchange services. You offer service. Some service. If you see someone's qualities that you like, you may offer some service. Not necessarily in the mood of that I want you to be my spiritual master, but I want you to be my friend. So, okay. So you offer some service. And when that person accepts the service and reciprocates with you by feeling grateful or by sincerely thanking you, then what results is you have an experience that I offered some service to this person and I got a healthy reciprocation, or I didn't get a reciprocation. But if you don't get a reciprocation, if you don't get an acknowledgement, then the experience is not so positive. But if you get an acknowledgement, if you get an appreciation, if you get some reciprocation, then there's reciprocation and there's a positive exchange. And so over a series of these positive exchanges, affection starts to develop. Now, another element besides service, or in other words, in order for service to continue, there has to be some exchange of words. In other words, you know, like somebody offers you some prasadam. And you say, well, Prabhu, thank you very much. I was very hungry. It was very nice. Thank you. One of these days, I'm going to reciprocate with you and I'm going to cook for you sometime or something. And so when you make a promise or you say something to a person, what's the difference? Like, Garuda, if I say to you, you know, before you leave India, I'm going to take you on a Govardhan Park. I'm going to take you to my favorite spot on Govardhan. And I tell you this. Because let's say I know you like Govardhan. So you say, oh, that's great. I'm looking forward to that. But then I don't keep my word. If I keep my word, how do you feel? As compared to if I don't keep my word. You feel I'm honest and dependable.
If you kept your word, I would feel that you were an honest person.
Okay.
Just
and behind the back. So then what does it mean? It means my words do not come true. Right?
Yeah.
Or in other words, what is your attitude towards a person who means what he says and towards a person who says things that he doesn't mean?
Respect the person more.
Right. What else? You respect him more? What?
Trust him.
Exactly. Trust develops. Trust is the word I'm looking for. Huh? Confidence. Trust. When you have a series of exchanges, and what happens is you develop trust in the other person, in the other person's words. I'm going to lend you, hey, can you lend me 20 rupees? I need to get some Mahaprasad. I left my money in my room, okay? I'm going to give it back to you right in an hour. And in an hour, I give it back to you. And I thank you for saving me the trip to having to go back and get it. So then you trust me. If you see that he's kept his word, then I trust this person. And because I trust this person, I'm eager to engage in more reciprocation. I'm eager to engage in more service with the person that I trust. And after a series of positive experiences where trust develops, then affection develops, and then love develops. So the basis, what is at the basis of love and trust, this movement is supposed to be built on love and trust, Prabhupada said, right? So what is the basis of the love is trusting each other. And in order to develop trust, one must experience honesty. Honest dealings. Which again goes back to what? Straightforwardness. Satovrite. So now if the Krishna consciousness movement is made, is built to create a facility for engaging in love and trust, at the very bottom of it, we have to be honest with each other. And if we're failing to be honest with each other, the rest of it, there's no trust will develop, no confidence, no affection, no love will develop. At least that's how it appears to me. So therefore, when we deal with each other, this is a must. When devotees deal with each other, there should be an attitude of I want to give to this person, and I'm going to be honest with this person. And if we do these two things we can choose to do. We can choose, in other words, it's our decision whether to do this or not. I'm going to be honest. I can be honest or dishonest. It's my choice. And I can choose to serve or not serve. And if I'm going to develop love with a certain devotee, then I make choices to develop that. And if I fail, I have to take responsibility for that. Now again, what happens if I offer service and honesty to a person and they don't reciprocate with honesty, then I can choose to spend my energy somewhere else on some other person. But still not try to get even with that person. You know, still try to help the person, but just perhaps you don't want to dedicate as much time to the effort. And that's all right. So these are the basic elements. So love is work. We say devotional service. Service means work. So we are on the path of devotional work. At a certain stage of development, that mood of service intensifies and produces various feelings. These feelings are only symptoms of love. They are not the love itself. One who wants to arrive at the feelings prematurely without doing the work is a sentimentalist, right? If you just meet a person and you have no series of positive experiences, then and you may feel something towards that person, then that sentiment, and in other words, because it's not based on your experience, it's just based on some intuitive thing which could develop into love, but still there's a difference because there's no experience at the foundation of it. And sentiment can change very easy. Whereas love, once love is developed, it is difficult to destroy. It can be destroyed, but it can be destroyed to some degree. At least the relationship can be destroyed. But you know that analogy? There's an analogy given somewhere in one of Prabhupada's purports, I think in the third canto, which demonstrates, he's talking about the heart of a Duratma and the heart of a Mahatma, and the contrast in their difference. He says, the heart of a wicked man is compared to a clay pot. You see these little kulara, these little clay pots they make in India, although they're going out quickly to be replaced by plastic cups. But this clay cup, you see, after people drink their chai or whatever out of it, they throw it on the ground and it breaks. So they say the heart of a wicked man is compared to a clay pot, and that it is very easy to break and impossible to mend it together again. So the nature of a wicked man is that his heart is like a clay pot. Means if you do the slightest thing to offend a wicked man, the relationship is broken for good and he immediately becomes your enemy. Whereas the heart of a Mahatma, the heart of a great soul, is compared to a golden pot. The characteristics of a golden pot is that it is difficult to break because gold is very pliable. It bends and gives. But even if you do break it, it's very easy to mend because you can weld it with other gold and you can polish it and you won't even see where it was broken. So it means a Mahatma has this love. So it's like, he doesn't take insult easily. If he has love for someone, He is forgiving. Whereas a Duratma, he doesn't have the power to forgive. In other words, sentiment and love differ in the fact that one is based on feeling and the other is based on experience and service. So love is not a feeling, love is a service or a work, something to be learned like any other art, with a theory to be mastered and then willfully put into practice, like learning cooking. In other words, we have to learn how to love by practicing these elements that we discussed. So now, let's discuss each one. Dadati means giving in charity. So we give in charity according to one's status. Prabhupada in this purport says, what the Krishna Consciousness Movement gives is knowledge about devotional service. That is our giving to the rest of the world. We give books which teach one how to develop love of God. We give prasadam. We give the holy name. We go to public places and give the holy name. But among ourselves, we should give according to our status, just like we see in the scripture. You know, just like if I want to give something to Gaur Gopal, he's a householder or wearing white. So some things I could give him that are appropriate that would not be appropriate for giving someone who's a brahmachari, right? A brahmachari, like at least we know from scripture and the appearance of Lord Vamana, who Lord Krishna incarnated as a dwarf brahmachari. And when he appeared, all the demigods came and they gave him different gifts. 11 items they gave him. So these are appropriate gifts for a brahmachari. Who remembers any of those items? They gave him a water pot. They gave him a Brahman thread. Huh? A kopin. They gave him kopins. Who gave him the kopins? Huh? No, his mother. His mother. His mother gave him the kopins. I remember there was a kid in the Gurukul once who would go home for the weekend and would come back with underwear on, you know. And I'd say, what happens is my mother took away my kopins and gave me this underwear. She doesn't like me to wear kopins. And I said, but you know, it's the rule in the school that brahmacharis have to wear kopins. So the guy was, you know, he didn't know what to do. He wanted to obey his teacher and he wanted to obey his mother. So what he did is he put his kopins on underneath his underwear. But anyway, it's interesting that it's actually Vamana's mother who gave him the kopins. So he got kopins, he got a Brahman's thread, he got a water pot. What else did he get? He got an umbrella. Huh? He got a kusha grass belt. Is that what you said? Belt? A kusha grass belt. A deer skin to cover himself. That's not mentioned. Although that's okay for a brahmachari to have, but it's not. He got an umbrella. He also got he got a staff. He got a brahmachari danda. He got a begging bowl. And then he got, I think it was Uma that gave him his first alms. He got some alms. And he also got rudraksha beads. He got 11 things. So these things are this is all you should give to the brahmacharis. All you householders. This is authorized that this, when you give some charity to a brahmachari, this is it. Now we see the contrast when King Vena, in the Bhagavatam, when King Vena, which body was churned, and Prithu Maharaj, King Prithu, and Archie appeared from the churning of Vena's body, again, all the demigods came and they offered gifts to Prithu Maharaj. They gave him, I don't remember exactly, but I know they gave him an umbrella, but it sprayed a mist, a cooling mist, and it was glowing like the moon. They gave him a pair of shoes that when you put the shoes on, the shoes would carry him to wherever his mind thought. They gave him a chariot, a beautiful golden chariot or valuable chariot with jewels and ornaments and horses that could fly and take him wherever he desired to go. And they gave him very opulent things, which are suitable for a king, a grihastha. But they're not, we see that some gifts are suitable for grihasthas or kshatriyas, and some gifts, those same gifts would not be suitable to a brahmana or to a brahmachari. So when we're giving in charity, exercising this principle, we have to take into consideration the status of the individual and give according to his status. And another element in giving is it should not say like the householders are the ones that say they have to give so much charity. Brahmacharis also give, where everyone gives, but one should not, at least on, when you accept, when you're accepting charity, giving in charity and accepting charity, when you accept, you should make sure that you're not accepting more than you require, and that you're not taxing the person, you're not excessively taxing the person that's giving to you. That, you know, you're not accepting more, you know, so much that the person who's giving it is going to experience a difficulty because he's giving it. So this is a very important element in this exchange of giving and taking charity. So when we accept gifts, we should accept them with a proper attitude. You know, I mean, of course, there's a whole thing about etiquette. You accept things with your right hand, don't accept things with your left hand. So many things in etiquette. And sometimes, say, let's say in the case of a brahmachari, let's say you go to someone's house and to do a preaching program, and the person, the hosts, the people holding the program, they offer you something that's inappropriate, just simply because they don't know what things could be given to a brahmachari. Let's say they may give you some white cloth with a very wide border of, you know, red, green, and purple. And white cloth. So, you know, you may say, no, this is not a proper dhoti for me. I'm supposed to wear just very plain clothes. This is something very kind, very nice for a householder, but a brahmachari should dress very simply. So I won't accept. But then that could, you know, that could really frustrate the host of the program. Better to accept and say, okay, I'll give this to my teacher. I'll give this to one senior devotee in charity, one pujari, I'll give it to him. And accept it and thank them and reciprocate with them. And accept it on behalf of someone else. Accept it so that they can benefit. So sometimes you may have to accept things that are not appropriate, but for the benefit of the person giving, you may accept. And then you decide how to pass it on to someone else. So, Guhyam, revealing your mind and confidence. So you should, we should take some caution in choosing who we want to reveal our mind and confidence to. Generally, you want to reveal your mind and confidence with someone who you're convinced is, of course, honest, who is a friend, who has your best interest in mind. And ideally also, it's easier to reveal your mind and confidence to someone who can help you, someone who you're confident has an answer or can help you, help guide you to find an answer to your problems. You want to be careful that you don't reveal your mind to someone who is going to use the information against you and harm you with it. So revealing one's mind in confidence and inquiring confidentially. So there should be a proper attitude in inquiry. We know from Bhagavad Gita that the disciple, he inquires from his spiritual master. It is his duty to inquire, but not to make challenges, you know, but one should inquire submissively. So in inquiring from another person, you should have the right attitude, the right intentions, that I want to, even as far as, say, like inquiring a philosophical answer, you may want to inquire just to find out the answer so you can give the answer when you're next asked. In other words, you may inquire for a selfish purpose. Not because you want to know the truth and apply it in your life, but you want to arm yourself with more quotes so you can appear like a more learned person. So we should have the proper attitude in inquiry. And then, bhungte in bhojayate, serving prasadam and accepting prasadam. This is a very important service. And of course, I don't want, you know, there's a whole, in your Vaishnava etiquette class, you might have discussed the proper way to serve prasadam and the proper attitude in which to do it. But basically, we should learn the etiquette. Like when we serve prasadam in the temple especially, the most senior, the most well-behaved should be the ones who serve, not the new bhaktas. Because they usually don't know, you know, they don't know the standard of cleanliness and so on. How we don't touch the serving spoon to the plate of the individual. How we don't talk when we serve, because when you speak sometimes some small bits of saliva come out. You don't talk when you have your mouth over the serving bucket. You don't, and you don't just like, how much do you want? And the guy says, I just want this much. And you go, ha, 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 whack. And you give him this much. You know, it's just like, it's not proper. It doesn't help the exchange. It doesn't help love and trust develop unless you serve properly and you accept properly. So these are the six exchanges in brief. And when these are done properly, love can develop. And when they're not done properly, then there's very little hope that we're actually going to progress in devotional service. There's very little hope we're going to live in peace and harmony in the ashram. Or there's very little hope you're going to live in peace and harmony in your own home, if you have your own household, without these elements being there. So then, as we discussed earlier, honesty is the key element in all this. So now, what is it that undermines honesty? In other words, we know, okay, from the positive side, we should be honest. And then what activity should we avoid that destroys honesty or undermines honesty, uproots honesty? Duplicity. Very good. Duplicity, deceitfulness, kutinati, what's called kutinati, or, deceitfulness. The opposite of honesty. There are some statements in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Kutinati, or diplomatic behavior, deceitfulness, cannot satisfy the soul. It cannot even satisfy the body or the mind. The culprit mind is always suspicious. Therefore, our dealing should always be straightforward and approved by Vedic authorities. Now listen to this, Prabhupada writes, if we treat people diplomatically or duplicitously, our spiritual advancement is obstructed. This is from his purport in Madhya Leela, 9th chapter, text 159. So it means you cannot, if you're diplomatic and duplicitous, your advancement is obstructed. You cannot progress. In the purport of 8.12 in the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada writes, in the 8th chapter, there's a list of items, and one of them is simplicity. He says, simplicity means that without diplomacy, one should be so straightforward that he can disclose the real truth even to an enemy. So it means we have to avoid diplomacy. And we should be straightforward. In the purport of 6.7.15, Prabhupada writes, if society is guided by political diplomacy, with one nation maneuvering against another, it will certainly sink like a stone boat. Political maneuvering and diplomacy will not save human society. People must take to Krishna consciousness to understand the aim of life, to understand God, and to fulfill the human mission. So these are a few of the many statements where Prabhupada points out we have to be straightforward, we have to be honest, we have to avoid kutinati. it doesn't satisfy the self. We think by sometimes that by being duplicitous, we're going to get what we want. But here Prabhupada clearly says, it does not satisfy the soul, doesn't satisfy the body or the mind. If you see what happens when, let's say, you behave deceitfully or duplicitously with someone, then you're always afraid that that's going to be found out. And then, you know, you tell one small lie and you end up having to tell 10 others in order to preserve that one. So it makes one completely dishonest in the long run. Whereas if you're always honest, you're always straightforward, then your mind is at ease, your mind is at peace. That you never, you know, you're hiding nothing. And so therefore, you can have some peace of mind. So that's generally what information I wanted to present to you. Now if you have any questions, we have about 30 minutes, 35 minutes. Shanti, his mind, we should not reveal his mind. Where one should be somewhat selective in who he reveals his mind to. So I don't see, I mean, I can see where you might, that might pose a contradiction, but in other words, like, let's say I have a personal problem and I want to find somebody to reveal my mind, and by doing that I want to develop love with that person. So I'm going to make sure that person is a devotee, first of all, not an enemy. An enemy means someone who's not a devotee, obviously. I mean, we may have enmity among ourselves, but it's not like that, you know, that may be some disagreement, but that's not like really hardcore enmity. But even then, I may not reveal my mind to a devotee. I won't reveal my mind. Say, if I have a personal problem, I'm going to reveal it probably to a senior, someone who's senior to me, and who knows me, and who I'm confident won't spread, he won't break confidence. I'm not going to reveal it. Let's say I have a philosophical doubt. And I'm not going to reveal it to, say, a new bhakta who's just coming, who has so many doubts. And then here I am, I'm going to reveal to him a doubt which is going to make his faith even weaker. And he can't answer, he can't help me with my doubt. And in fact, it will actually just have a negative effect on him. So like one time it happened to me like that. I was in Heidelberg, I think, and this new bhakta comes to me from, he came from East Germany. And he said, you know, I just got out of, I ran across the Berlin Wall or whatever, and I'm over here and I'm learning about Krishna consciousness over there. We don't know anything about it. And I'm pretty fascinated by, you know, just by chanting Maha Mantra you can become happy, and I'm chanting, but my mind is disturbed. I'm chanting, but it's hard for me. And how long have you been chanting? And I said, well, maybe 20 years. He said, yeah, and you must be getting a real taste, eh? You must be really tasting the nectar of chanting. You know, like they talk about after you chant for some time, then you enter into, you get a taste of the holy name, and you must be relishing it after 20 years, right? And I had to be honest. I said, no, I'm not. I'm still chanting out of obedience to my guru. And he looked at me and said, after 20 years? He just was like, oh, God. You mean that? I thought, like, you know, after 2 or 3 months, I'd be getting a taste of something. And you've been chanting 20 years? And you're not getting that taste? He just hung his bead bag on the wall and said, I'm going to go clean the kitchen. Right? In other words, it's like, I wanted to be honest, and I wasn't really revealing my mind. I was just being honest. But I can see how if you reveal your mind about a doubt you have to someone younger, they're not going to help you, and you may discourage them. Whereas if you reveal your mind to someone who's older, more experienced, then there's every chance that person has already been through it, and he's going to dispel your doubt and pull you up. So the principle is then you reveal your mind to someone who's suitable. And an enemy, then we may be straightforward, but that's different than revealing your mind. Now, an interesting thing you should know about honesty also is, again, just like they bring this scenario where, let's say you're standing on a corner, a choraha, you know, a crossroads, and all of a sudden running towards you, you see a cow with her tail up, running in great fear. And she comes towards you and she goes to the right side. And you're wondering, what's the matter? And then all of a sudden, after she goes to the right side, you see a butcher running with a knife. And he comes to you and says, which way did the cow go? He's a butcher, he's got blood on his face. So now, being honest, honest means she went that way. Yes. And you point to the left. Because honesty means you're doing what is religious, you're doing dharma, you're doing what is right, you're protecting cows, you're protecting religious principles. So honest doesn't mean I'll help you go grab her, and to be honest. Right? Honest means we do, and the thing, we do what's best for the other person. Right? And it's not helpful to help that man kill another animal. So again, you know, honesty doesn't always mean saying yes, 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 yes. There are unusual circumstances where you know. But again, you have to. It's not for your own. It's not to protect yourself or your own interests that you may bend the truth. But it's for the purpose of pleasing Guru and Krishna that can be an honest thing to do at certain unusual times. We should be very careful not to twist this to serve our own selfish purposes. Devadeva? Because again, we have to question whether that's real love or not. I question whether it's love. In other words, if a man and a woman are in love, and again, we're defining love like I did here, that there's respect, right? There's care, responsibility, respect, and knowledge. And let's say I'm the wife, and I know that you have very strong relationships with your friends, and you need them. So I'm not going to do anything to disrupt them. If I really love you, I'm going to say, well, you know, you should take some time and go with your friends. Don't stay home all the time with me. But like, say, I've seen it many times, or it's commonly known, especially in India, I think, where two brothers may be very strong, or the family may be very strong, and then sometimes the person marries, when he gets married, then the wife, because of some whatever reason, she demands so much of the attention of the man that he neglects his brothers, and he becomes somewhat estranged from the family. Sometimes it happens like that. I know it happened in my family like that, where my brother, when he married, his wife was, you know, just kept, she put a ring in his nose, and she wouldn't let him look anywhere except, you know, in the house. And then the kids came, and then you just have to concentrate on here, don't worry about where your brothers are or whatever, you know, your responsibility is here. And so all of our, you know, we don't even know each other anymore. I know you guys better than I know my own brother. So but I say that's using a person. That's not giving. So I say that's not real love. It's a semblance of love. It's a business deal, but it's not real love. If it were real love, then the husband could say, you know, I need to get away from the family every once in a while, take a break, and be with my friends, and just be free from the responsibilities and the demands of, like some of you householders are here in Vrindavan. You know, you just took a break from your family responsibilities. You're going to go back and you'll be refreshed and ready to take further responsibility. And the wife, if she loves the husband, she'll encourage that sometimes. Well, of course, there's no karma there, right? In the transcendental world, but Krishna expresses how he's purchased by the love of his devotees. In other words, the more selfless the devotees are towards Krishna, the more his nature is. It's not karma, but it's his nature. By nature, he's more obliged to reciprocate with them. So the more we give our hearts to Krishna, the more he reciprocates with us. As they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Those who are fully surrendered unto me, then I reciprocate with them fully. So much so that just like in Dwarka, Krishna married 16,108 wives and he gave each one of them a palace, and each one of them was in the illusion that she had his exclusive attention. And he satisfied each one of them in the particular way that she required. And as much as they were surrendered to him, then he is fully reciprocating. Or in the Ras dance, each one of them is thinking that Krishna is dancing with her exclusively. So the dynamic continues, but it's not motivated by, in other words, it's not a karmic, there's no law, you know, in other words, it's just Krishna's nature that he reciprocates. And so when one, those who are surrendered to him, those who, you know, who serve him, then he reciprocates by serving them. That is just his nature. That is the nature of bhakti. And the more one gives, the more pleasure he receives. As explained that even in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's explained that when a gopi, when she sees that Krishna wants to enjoy with another gopi, not with herself, she gets so much pleasure out of enjoying with Krishna. But when she sees he wants to enjoy with another gopi, and she pushes that gopi, she makes arrangements for them to meet. It's explained that she experiences 10 million times more pleasure than she did when she associated with Krishna personally. You know, because she's selflessly trying to accommodate Krishna's desire. And so his reciprocation is more so.
Yes.
So but you're saying it wrong. You're saying love based on feeling and sentiment. It's not love. It's sentiment. In other words, if I have a feel, let's say we just met, and I have a positive feeling towards you, I can't say that that's love, because I don't trust you. We haven't done anything to develop trust or affection. We've not had any honest dealings. So I have a sentiment. It may be accurate. Right? It may be accurate. I think we're going to get along. But then, when we exchange and we develop confidence and trust, and we see we have honest dealings, then I can say I've developed love for you. If I say that before, then I'm mistaking sentiment for love. Do you understand? You begin, like he said, to serve. In other words, but you know, so the sentiment may be there, so you serve and develop love. You may fantasize. That's often what happens between men and women that don't know each other. They see each other and they start thinking, this is the perfect wife. This one's going to be the perfect one for me. And they don't know each other, and consequently they create an image of the other that's inaccurate. Sometimes. Arvind. About Lakshman and? Well, like in Ram Raja, in the kingdom of Ram, you know, the citizen, you know, just it also occurs in Krishna book, right? And that Brahmana said, every time a son was born, the son died, and they appealed to, was it Yudhisthira or Arjun? And Arjun, you know, as a Kshatriya, you know, it's my responsibility to protect the citizens, and this should not be happening. So something's wrong in the kingdom if it can happen. So Ram also, something is wrong in the kingdom if a citizen is in distress, if a citizen feels that, you know, he's doing his duty and he's not getting the result he should get by according to Dharma, then it is the responsibility of the king to do something to rectify the situation. So it is the duty of the citizens to have respect for the king. And he saw that one dobi didn't have respect. So, out of love for the citizens, or out of responsibility as a king, that, in other words, he set a very important example that when the subordinates have a complaint, or they have at least a legitimate complaint, or they have a concern, what we see is usually when someone criticizes an authority, they're silenced. Their life's in danger, or they're silenced, or they're isolated, or their reputation is ruined, their credibility is ruined. They're usually under the attack of the powerful authority. But Ram showed, actually, I should accept critical feedback. I want to know what the citizens actually think about me. Actually, he went out incognito to get that information. No one would have told him that to his face. But he wanted to know what are the people's actual feelings towards their leader. And I'm going to take, and if I feel that they're doubting me, they have doubts about their leader, then I'm taking the responsibility to act in such a way to win their confidence. Not make them look like the bad guys and excommunicate them or punish them. So he's teaching that example. And of course, some people say, well, it was an injustice to Sita because she was chaste. But of course, and I don't know Ramayana. I've read it a couple of times, but I have not studied it. But from Krishna Lila, we know that when Krishna separates himself from his beloved gopis, that it actually increases their loving feelings towards him. In other words, it's not a negative, you know, that vipralamba seva, or service in separation, is more intense than service in union. So, because this is I've not heard, but I'm sure that Sita did not have to suffer the absence of Ram. Rather, she might have suffered the absence of Ram, but in separation, her feelings of love were intensified. I don't think that he actually made her suffer in order to please one washerman. You follow what I'm saying? He would be correcting one shortcoming, but creating another shortcoming if he were doing that, right? Protecting a citizen and neglecting his wife, that's not his program. His program is to satisfy everyone in the kingdom. So I'm confident he did that. Well, first of all, that you notice it is already a good start. It's already a step in the right direction. That you notice, well, I'm doing this, and I'm doing this because I'm expecting something. So like I'm washing pots, and I'm cleaning the pots very nicely, because I know last time when I did it right, I got, you know, the cook gave me some Mahaprasad when I left the kitchen. So I'll do it again very nicely with the hope that they give me some of those pakoras that they cooked. So this would mean I'm doing it. I'm doing devotional service, but it's tinged with rajas. It's tinged with the expectation to get some, enjoy the fruits. So if I can detect that, then I can work on my attitude and try and minus that out of the equation. Try and take that out of the equation. Try and do it without expecting that. So, it's the more subtle the expectations are, the more difficult they are to get rid of. But I can give you no other answer, or at least I know no other answer except practice. Practice trying to do it purely. And even if you don't get the reciprocation you want, you can try. I've seen it in my own practice where sometimes especially when you travel and preach, many devotees, they have practical problems they want help with. And some devotees demand a lot of time. They have a lot of problems. And sometimes you spend a lot of time with them. And you give. And they're satisfied just to take. It doesn't occur to them that they should try to reciprocate with some service, or they like the arrangement that here's a person where I can take the weight off my shoulders and put it on their shoulders and then feel relief. And I'm relieved, but I never. It doesn't occur to them that maybe there's something they can do to relieve the weight off the person's shoulders that has helped them. But my experience with this is that if you do give to such a person and you get no reciprocation, their reciprocation comes from another place you don't expect. That's my personal experience. Now that's a little bit different than what you're talking about when you're trying to develop a particular relationship, and you're feeling perhaps that you're motivated to serve a person because you're expecting to get something in the future from that same person. Well, at least all I can offer you is that if you serve it with an attitude of giving and that person does not reciprocate, I can tell you, at least my experience is, you can expect the reciprocation from elsewhere. Sometimes they feel that I sacrificed so much for this particular temple. I collected so much money and I gave it to this temple, or I helped build a temple, or I sacrificed so much time and talent for this particular temple. And then when I had a little problem, I was given a kick in the teeth. And so maybe that temple president or those particular persons did not reciprocate with me, but I got so much unexpected reciprocation from another place where I didn't expect it. And the fact is, it's because Krishna is reciprocating. He has many agents. He doesn't have to reciprocate with you through that particular agent you're expecting. He can reciprocate. If you have served favorably, Krishna will reciprocate with you through an agent, another agent you may not expect. And still, we should try to serve without expecting anything in return. But it is Krishna's nature that he reciprocates. He may not do it again when we expect, but that is his nature. But still, we should not serve with an attitude that I'll do this knowing that he will reciprocate. Bhaktivinoda Thakur discusses this in his commentary on Dadati. He says that, like in Bhagavad Gita, it's explained that charity and sacrifice should never be given up. And he says that it is the householder's duty to give in charity, like we talked about, giving prasad to whoever comes to their house. So he says, let's say you're leaving the temple and there's some beggar in the street, give me 1 rupee. So, and you may feel obliged. You may give in charity to, say, a non-devotee. But he said you should do it with an attitude of duty rather than an attitude of developing love. He says these 6 exchanges are specifically said to be performed among the devotees. And you may perform, say, giving prasadam to someone who's not a devotee. You should give that prasadam to someone out of a sense of duty, not out of a sense that I want to develop love with this person. So you may do the same thing, but the attitude is different. Well, there's an attitude that I want to help a person, but at the same time I'm not looking for an ongoing thing necessarily. I'm not going to reveal my mind to this person. I may give in charity, or I might give prasadam, like we do with Food for Life. So you should give according to their status. Again, just like I remember one time in Kedarnath, in Padayatra, we walked up to Kedarnath, and we got to the top there, and in front of Kedarnath's temple, Lord Shiva's temple, there was a wealthy man who just completed this pilgrimage. So he wanted to give something in charity to all the sadhus there. So he gave each one a packet of bidis. And everybody is smoking bidis up there. And you know, the air is so thin already. So in other words, that is not proper charity. Give it the proper time, proper place, to the proper person. There's charity in the mode of goodness, passion, and ignorance, we know from the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So let's say a drunkard, you don't see him here so much. But in the West, you always see a guy who's an alcoholic on the street, and he comes to give me a quarter. He spits on the windshield of the car and wipes it off with his sleeve. And he's acting like he's cleaning the windshield, and he earned 25 cents. And you know, as soon as you give him, he's going to go buy a bottle of wine and drink it and lay on the sidewalk. So to give him money is obviously harmful and detrimental to him. So to that person, the householder, who wants to give charity, then he should give him prasad. Something he cannot misuse as much as possible. Or, you know, offer him something that will be helpful for him, not something that he will use to further his own sinful activities. So that much intelligence must be used when we're given charity, out of duty even. I think it's an element, it's an expression of love. In other words, I've seen many times where a misunderstanding between two people is often the impetus, like you say, to reveal your mind and confidence, And after patching things up, the relationship is even thicker. Many times I've seen that. That a disagreement, when there's a commitment on the part of two, well, when they're actually devotees, committed to each other, sometimes there's a misunderstanding or even an offense. But because there's that commitment, there is enough experience of positive things that this is just a small thing. You know, this is an unusual event. It is not consistent with so many others that had gone before. Then sometimes that is an impetus to thicken the relationship. And so I think trying to work through these things is a demonstration of commitment and confidence and respect for the other. So I think it's also an element of expressing love. Huh? I don't think that you're asking a question. I think you're making a statement, but I don't see that it's a question. We have a test. We avoid the test. So I still don't see what is the question. No, so you're making a statement that sometimes we shy away from, we have a test and we don't try to cross the test. We don't try and pass the test. Okay? But he's talking about trying to keep a relationship together. You're talking about trying to cross a test within a relationship. So I think it's the same question. That if there's if a relationship is tested and you're committed to preserving the relationship and developing love, then you should reveal your mind in confidence and try to clear away the misunderstanding so that the love can continue to develop. All right, so then tomorrow we'll discuss verses 5 and 6, so please read ahead and prepare some questions or whatever. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.